Hello and welcome to Women for Elections in Conversation with podcast series. As a way to extend our connections with you throughout this global pandemic, Women for Election has developed an online series where some of the most prominent leaders, mainly women, in Irish politics, chat with some of our leading journalists about political life, the issues of the day and the need for gender equality. In this episode, leading Irish Times political correspondent Jennifer Bray hosts a riveting conversation with Deputy Holly Kearns. We will hear Holly's passion for driving change as the only female TD from the Cork constituencies. Holly tells us about her journey from farming to become the first Social Democrat TD elected in Cork in 2020. As the only woman TD from Ireland's largest county, we hear about the gender wall she is breaking down in everyday politics. It's quite remarkable, really, to realise that there are six times the number of Micheáls and Michaels than women from the Cork constituency currently elected to the Dáil. Among the many topics in this episode, Holly shares her passion for progressing and protecting the diversity of women and girls' rights in Ireland right now. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and as ever, please feel free to subscribe to the Women for Election podcast. You can also sign up for our newsletter on our website, and if you can spare some cash, please donate also via our website to help us do more. This is great. I think we're just getting ready to start as we're waiting for people to come into the room. We've lots of people signed up tonight, which is very exciting for our first In Conversation series of the year 2021. We had a fantastic year last year. I'm Katrina Gleeson. I'm the new CEO of Women for Election, and delighted that on a Monday evening, this is how I get to spend my time in a pandemic with two fantastic leaders, both in journalism and in politics. Tonight we have Irish Times political correspondent and writer Jennifer Bray, and we are delighted that she's going to be in conversation with a very new entrant to the world of national politics, but a very welcome entrant to the world of national politics, Deputy Holly Kearns. So thank you both for joining us. Just by way of background, and while the people are continuing to join us, Jennifer, as I see, working since 2008 as a journalist, started first with the Sunday Tribune, covered many portfolios, and has made her way through a number of leading publications, and is now working with the Irish Times as their political correspondent. So Jennifer, delighted to have you on board with us tonight. And Holly Kearns, Deputy Holly Kearns, who was elected from the Cork South West constituency last February, a year in the position, the only woman representing her constituency in Cork, tipped somebody else in the polls in 2019 when she won the local council seat by one vote. So every vote counts was probably your motto for the next round, Holly. I remember first coming on your leadership when you were elected last year when I was working with Safe Ireland, and quite inspired by the work you did behind the scenes to help us at the time in Safe Ireland drive changes, particularly around domestic violence and the rent supplement. And your name continues to crop up on issues that are so important to Irish society. Your portfolio, in terms of your responsibilities in the Social Democrats, is quite diverse, multitasker, from agriculture to disability and everything in between. So really appreciate all of the work you've been doing, and currently in the media, all the work you're doing in relation to the Mother and Babies Home Commission. So I'm not going to spend much time, much else talking. You're here to hear from Holly and from Jennifer. Just to say, in terms the room, Jennifer will be fielding questions and answers at the end of the interview. So if you have any questions or answers, please type them in there to the Q&A box. We are running for the hour, and hope you enjoy your evening. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a million, Katrina, and I'm absolutely delighted to be here this evening and for this chat with yourself, Holly. I suppose we'll just get straight into it, Holly. I saw the badge. Yes. I think you have here. I found my own one on the bookshelf from last year, calling for more women, more men all. And it has been just over a year since the general election. Is it more important now that we get women into politics? I suppose, especially in light of the fact the last year has been completely taken up by the pandemic, and we've seen how not having women in senior positions has such a detrimental impact on the lives of not only women, but their families, of men, of every citizen in the country. Is it more important now than ever that we have more women in politics, and why?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's probably always been important, but it feels so important now. And, you know, Katrina touched on bits of it there in relation to domestic violence. And, you know, I suppose we know that we have quite a low number of female representatives in Irish politics. And I think we see how that really filters down, you know, and becomes so problematic in terms of it's all in the name. It's your representative, your public representative, it's representation. And 50% of the population are just not adequately represented. And, you know, that just, it filters down into everything. Also, Katrina referenced the mother and baby homes there. I think it's difficult to imagine that women would have been, you know, kind of treated in the way they have been historically if we had more women in positions of power. And around those decision-making tables, we've, you know, it's really been highlighted in with regard to COVID. So like that with domestic violence, you know, just to give one example in this answer that, you know, in every country in Europe, we have the thing called the Istanbul Convention, which gives us guidelines with regard to domestic violence refuge space. And Ireland is the only country in Europe that gives one refuge space per 10,000 women, whereas every other country gives one refuge space per 10,000 people. So as a result, we have 50% less. So one example of how that, you know, I think it just really filters down that we just desperately need more female participation.
Absolutely. And Katrina mentioned there as well, I suppose, that, you know, you're the only female TD for all of Cork City and County. I would be interested, well, we can go into the pandemic, I suppose, a little bit later, but I would be interested to go back a little bit to the election and to find out, you know, what was your experience running last February, particularly because obviously there were plenty of other men running. What did you find that you had to do differently in the campaign? Or did you find that you had to go the extra mile or that, you know, to be viewed as authentic, believable, all those things that women, you know, are often led to believe is supposed to be harder for us. You know, what was your experience? Was it very different to your male counterparts?
I presume it was, and I suppose I'll never know how everybody else experienced the election, but I never forget, like, in the lead up to the election, you know, there's hustings and, you know, so everyone gets together for a particular topic. So it'd be like a hustings in relation to disability, hustings in relation to everything. And I was particularly looking forward to the agriculture one because it's my specific interest. I've, you know, worked in the industry. I grew up on a farm. I have a master's in it. And, you know, so it's a topic I'm very engaged in, one of my motivations for going into politics. And I remember arriving at the hustings and there was like already, you know, a good few of the candidates at the top table or whatever. And then there's a kind of chair and the audience who would give questions. And the chair of the meeting, like when I first arrived, he said, you know, when I walked in, oh, you can sit down because you're good looking. Made me very uncomfortable just to begin, you know, just to kick off. And then as he would take questions from the audience, the entire way through the hustings, he'd say, oh, first that question will go to Deputy Collins. Now we'll go to Councillor Hayes. And like, bear in mind, I was a councillor at the time, so he could have said Councillor Cairns or whatever, Holly. He'd say, and now we'll go to that little girl. We'll go to that little girl next. The entire thing. And like I said, you know, worked in the industry, grew up on a farm, have a master's in it. So I was literally just being disregarded because I was a female candidate. You know, it's that blatant and that basic. So it does, it, you know, you feel it the whole way through. But I also think that, what, you know, there's so many strengths. So like the way that I became engaged in politics was really through the repeal referendum. And without realizing it, I think me and my entire team had a completely different approach because that was all of our introduction to politics. So you know, the way you'd get approached, I don't know what it's like in everyone else's constituency, but you get a call from a, you know, one of the older parties canvassing and they might thrust a leaflet at you and be like, you'll think of them on the day or you'll give them a scratch or whatever. And we just would never have thought of doing that. Like I would never knock on a door and be just thrust a leaflet at someone the head away. So we'd be saying, you know, for example, in repeal, have you thought about what way you're voting? You know, if somebody had concerns, you go into those concerns and discuss them. So in the election, we'd say, you know, I'm running for election because this is what I stand for. This is what I believe we need to change. And, you know, all of these things. And of course, people responded to that. So it was really like what me and the team did. It's really a team effort. Like it's never down to one person. We didn't focus on anything else that was going on around us. We focused on our own campaign and what we were about. And that proved to just be really effective. So pros and cons.
Pros and cons. I'm so interested in that anecdote that you gave about, you know, going in for that debate. And I think some people, when they hear that, might be like, oh, my God, I can't believe that that happens, you know, in this day and age. But it happens all day, every day, all the time in various different fields that women work in. And it's still shocking, but it still happens. And I wonder, is part of that because there's still women in any kind of field, but especially politics, there's still this view that we can't be taken quite as seriously as the men. You know, we don't think quite as deeply, or, you know, we don't have thoughts that are quite as complex as our male. Is there still that view that, you know, it's the little girl thing, and you've come up against this a couple of times yourself, and I'd like to get into that later as well. But is that a thing still? You know, we can't be taken seriously, especially when you're younger, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Like that, you know, I remember on the first day of the term in Cork County Council after I got elected, and, you know, seeing a colleague congratulate all of the newcomers, essentially, which is lovely. But going around, and he was saying, you know, like the four people I watched him congratulate before me happened to be male or whatever, and saying like, congratulations, fantastic campaign, well deserved, good man yourself type of thing. And we got to me, he patted me on the shoulder and said, well done, you look great.
Oh, for God's sake.
So like, totally, of course, like it wasn't like great campaign, well done, or, you know, and in fairness, like we'd gone up against the odds, like a first time candidate, brand new to politics in a very new party that for the most part people hadn't heard of in Cork Southwest at the time. So you think you might just get a bit of credit for your campaign at that point, but no.
No, there's right. Still that superficiality there, the way some men treat women in politics. It's either you have to comment on your looks or your age or some other comment to make you, to remind you, you know, that you're somehow on a lesser scale of importance to them. And actually, like, there was a question I had for you, which was a little bit later on, but I think now that you've mentioned that comment, I'll probably go straight to it. Just in terms of the online side of things, I typed your name into Twitter earlier on, and the first thing that came up in terms of the most popular message or whatever was a meme of someone giving out last year. They're giving out about you and the fact that you had at the time a partner who's in Fianna Fáil, and, you know, saying, oh, just remembering that Holly Cairns, you know, is going out with someone in Fianna Fáil, and someone with a meme giving out and being annoyed. And the second message was about the same thing that was the most popular tweet. Then there was a comment about the board member from the greyhound industry who called you an ignorant little girl. Then there was a comment about a Fine Gael TD apologising for liking those comments. And then I looked at the recent tweets, and it was people commenting on your appearance. Like, is that not just so galling?
God, I'm glad I don't search my own name on Twitter.
Just in the name of research, Holly.
Staggering. Yeah, and I mean, like, I remember, you know, that time with the, you know, a member of a state board, imagine in 2020, it was the time referring to an elected representative in that way, an elected woman as an ignorant little girl.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so pervasive. And like, I remember, you know, when I went into the Dáil to address that, because normally like that, I don't search my own name on Twitter. You know, most of the time, like I say, just block it out, focus on what you're doing. There's no point in getting distracted by the nonsense, basically. But I couldn't actually avoid it when the Fine Gael TD apologized for liking the tweets, because I was just kind of inundated with media looking for comment on it. It's like, I better address it. And why shouldn't I address it? Like, you know, I don't want to address it. Women all over Ireland don't want to address it, but we can't really avoid it either when, like that, you're inundated with calls from the media because of Fine Gael TD's after liking this stupid comment about you. So I went in just to say, like, you know, this is completely unacceptable, and to actually, more importantly, challenge him to a debate, because he hadn't addressed any of the facts I'd raised in relation to the industry. Yeah. He just, you know, called that out. But when I looked around the room, Jennifer, I was the only woman in the room in the Dáil chamber. So not the only woman. Like, luckily, Catherine Connolly, we have the first female Lascian Corley, who I adore, was on the chair, but say everybody else who was present as a TD, I was the only woman in the room. So it's just, it's so ingrained, and it's so pervasive. Like, for example, I'm on the Dáil Reform Committee now, so that's where we look at the rules for the Dáil, you know, and how it runs, and the standing orders, essentially. So these have been scrutinised consistently by this Dáil Reform Committee for almost 100 years now. And recently I looked it up, and in the standing orders, it said chairman 137 times. It said chairperson twice. And guess how many times it said chairwoman? Zero times.
None. Yeah.
So I just put it to the committee, like, can we change it to chair or here, look, or whatever? And they were like, absolutely. But just that, that's how ingrained it is and how unnoticed. Like, we've been looking at these standing orders for 100 years consistently. That's the purpose of the Dáil Reform Committee. And nobody had noticed, you know, perhaps we should change that.
Yeah.
So it's a constant thing. But the best way to deal with that is to get more women involved. You know, the more women that are there, the less we'll encounter these kinds of situations. So I'm all for Women for Election and just encouraging more women to get involved, because we need you.
And that's just one kind of, not a small example, because it's actually kind of a big deal that, you know, you wouldn't even find the word woman in the standing orders of the National Parliament, you know. And it's just an example of small things that are become the norm over time. And all of a sudden, all those small things build up and you're working or dealing with a system that has been designed by men and that works kind of very much so in their favor. And you come in and, like you say, you find yourself defending yourself against very overtly sexist comments in a room with no other women, understanding orders that don't mention women. And then we ask ourselves, why don't women want to go into politics? You know, it's
seems like why.
But you know, in terms of that, we did learn today, which I had to double check this a few times, honest to God, because I just was like, can this be true? That Ireland ranks 101 in the world rankings for the number of female parliamentarians behind Afghanistan, Iraq, China. And we know that only 23% of TDs are women. And on the cabinet subcommittees, which we know now is where a lot of the power is at, just look at the decisions they make in relation to coronavirus and COVID, only 40% are women. Like, what is going on here? Why are we lagging so far behind, do you think?
Yeah, and just to like re-emphasize your point about the actual drastic numbers. So you mentioned a 101 on the list, yeah. And you mentioned before that I'm the only female TD of 18 in all of Cork. Like, another way of looking at that is that there's, imagine in Cork, there's six times more Michaels than there is women. There's six TDs with a variation of the name Michael elected in Cork and one single woman. And yeah, I mean, like, we just see it time and time again, like, and historically all the way up until today. So like, you know, the mother and baby homes is such a topical issue at the moment. Like, I think that, you know, the scale and impact of the misogyny and the control of women's bodies in Ireland is actually just, the scale of it is so horrifying when you look at that, the amount of women that were incarcerated. We lived in a society where, you know, sex outside of marriage was basically illegal. That was public policy. You know, no access to contraception. Abortion was illegal. Virtual immunity for rapists. Mm. Pregnancies were an inevitability. And when women got pregnant, they were incarcerated. Their children, you know, and babies put in mass graves and in septic tanks, some of their children, illegal vaccine trials carried out in them, sold abroad for money for the church, all facilitated by the state. You know, and like today still, these people are not getting justice. So that's like the level of it that we're dealing with. And I think, you know, sometimes we forget that the level of this. Like, my own grandmother had to stop working when she got married and she got her husband's PPS number and her name was changed. You know, all of these things, it's insane. And like you say, where all of these decisions are being made, that there's no women at these decision-making tables, it's not actually that surprising then that we're so underrepresented in relation to these decisions. They're like, throughout the pandemic, when we saw restrictions all across society at different times being reviewed, revised and eased in almost every case. So like, you could go back to the pub, go to weddings, and still, for example, women were giving birth on their own. So they're only allowed to have somebody with them during so-called active labor. So they could be like 24 hours in labor on their own. Really, really hard, you know, when things are going well, significantly, obviously massively harder when things don't go well and you receive bad news and for first time mums. But like, even I'm like, in the next election, this has to change. Like, we can't have a continuation of this anymore. That, you know, in the pandemic and the rise of cases in domestic violence, and Katrina obviously dealing with that so much, like, this absolutely has to change, you know, sooner rather than later. I think, you know, there's so many barriers, and we can go into them as well if you want. But
yeah, definitely. It's just interesting you mentioned kind of the way women were treated beyond politics, going back into history. Interesting to hear some people, in terms of the Mother and Baby Homes report, talk about how the report highlighted that, well, sure, these women would have been doing this work anyway, you know, inside the home, you know, what does it matter? Sure, that this was their life anyway. So it's, you know, almost like it's grand. It's kind of mind boggling when you hear that almost being just accepted as, oh, fine. But that's, I think, a totally different topic. I think there's a lot there that you kind of got into. And I suppose one of the things that is often asked about, you know, getting women into politics is, how can we help women get into politics? What are the current impediments, and what supports can we give women to do that? And sometimes it can be talked about in kind of almost an esoteric way that's sort of hard to access. Like, if we can go into some of the details, like, one thing that I, just from talking to female candidates during different elections, you know, the fact that they decided to go, what previously had held them back, something that comes up an awful lot is this idea of not having the confidence. And there was research done that showed that the more times you ask a woman to run, she'll eventually maybe decide, oh, well, I've been asked now 5 times, maybe I should think about it. Whereas maybe a male candidate would say, well, absolutely, of course, I will run in the election. I have all the qualities and attributes here. You know, how can we like convince women that you are absolutely good enough for this and you can absolutely do this?
Yeah, I guess, like, and I remember that going to an event in UCC, and it was just all the female public representatives for Cork. So it was like all councillors and one TD, and, you know, everybody kind of gave like a brief introduction to themselves and how they got involved in politics. And it was one of the students in the kind of lecture hall who pointed out that like every single one of us, actually, except Lorna Bogue, amazing, strong, powerful woman, every single one of us had been kind of asked to do it, or there was nobody else to do it, or, you know, that is something that is obviously a bit of a barrier, this putting ourselves forward. And you know, that's a difficult one to tackle. And there's that expression, to have the confidence of a, you know, mediocre middle-aged man kind of a thing. Like, and, you know, I don't know how we deal with that, but I do think that, you know, you have to see it to be it. And there's, you know, there's ways of tackling that. And I know that people have a massive aversion often to gender quotas, but like, I personally am a big fan of gender quotas. I think that they work, which is really good. I like that about them. We've waited now 100 years since the foundation of the state for it to just happen and for women to defy all of the odds when they're stacked up against them. This kind of, it should be the best person for the job. Like, in reality, we all know that, of course, there's just as many women who will be absolutely as good at the job as men. So that's just, you know,
100%.
Dispel that one there straight away.
100%.
And you know, and then there's so many other barriers. So like, one of the really obvious ones is like that there's no things like, you know, for example, there being no maternity leave for public representatives, from councillors to senators to TDs. But I think in reality, you know, there are things we can address and stuff. I think that the reality is that the biggest problem is, you know, because perhaps some like parties are they're old institutions almost in Ireland, like they're around since the foundation of the state. And what we have at the moment is a gender quota for how many women are on the ticket. And that's welcome, that's good. But like, what we saw in the election was blatant and awful. So I was seeing even the front page of the paper, a Fine Gael candidate saying, so, you know, I'm the candidate on the ticket, I'm going to get elected or whatever. And we're looking at these two other candidates as the additional candidates, which is sweep up the votes on the other side of the constituency, because they tick the gender and geography boxes. So what we have, instead of people, you know, the party's actually trying to get women elected, is they're just trying to meet their gender quota to get women on the ticket. There's no real or meaningful attempt to get women elected in that.
And yeah, definitely, yeah.
So the big parties, I think, are perhaps the biggest problem in engaging women in politics. They're not necessarily the big ones, because in fairness, like, it's the older ones that are more sort of ingrained in old school Irish politics. So for example, like the Labour Party don't have any female TDs. There's 37 TDs in Fianna Fáil, the biggest number of TDs in the country, and they have 5 female TDs. And I just think, you know, when you look at the newer parties, it's not that they have done all of this work and they spend all of this time engaging women in politics. It's like it just exists. It's, you know, because there isn't this old institutionalized way of doing things. So like, those parties, those newer ones, don't spend all of this time trying to engage women in politics and it not working. It just happens. And I think, you know, this is the biggest barrier, I think, for women in politics, that like, you can't endeavor to govern a society that promotes equality if that doesn't even exist within your own party. So then, without women involved in politics, the way that the governance happens, you can see the fallout of that up until this week in relation to mother and baby homes. You know, it's just so consistent. I think it's high time in Ireland, because when the public vote, for example, on an issue like marriage equality or, you know, reproductive rights, we are a shining light, you know, even in a European context, even in a global one, for voting for really progressive things. And I love that. But when we go about voting for elections, that somehow isn't what happens. We vote for, you know, we inherit our vote a lot. We vote for somebody who's helped us out locally, and that's understandable, but also sometimes unhelpful. If you want progressive policies in a progressive Ireland, you have to just vote for the policy and, you know, not the necessarily the person or the party that your family boys vote for. You know, voting for the Civil War all the time, like your grandmother's future, not your own. That, like, it's high time we just had a new, more progressive style of governance that promotes equality, and that equality has to exist within the party to be able to promote it, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's so interesting. I know that in the last both general and local elections, I spoke to women who had been added to the ticket, like you say, and were added to the ticket in the party's mind to meet that quota. And while they publicly said, you know, we have X amount of female candidates and X constituency and here and there, and aren't we great? The money and the resources went behind the campaign of men. And that was so demoralizing for the women who were involved, because they were basically being told, you are just the number that we want to have on this, and you are just the box that we'll take. And we don't believe actually that you will be elected, and we don't believe that you can do it. But stand up there in front of the camera and smile and, you know, talk about how isn't it great, you know, that I'm on the ticket or whatever, but behind closed doors, no support. And they were cut off from it. And like that, I think, has an even worse effect in terms of women, because you're, why would you do that? Why would you just do something that, you know, is just to be there? So they say, they can say that you're there. And that's definitely something that came up. The other thing I want to ask you about was another kind of practicality that I'm interested in. In terms of putting yourself forward for election, you have to really put yourself out there, obviously. And that involves, you know, going on radio, going on the television. And actually, this is something that I've struggled with in the media, the idea of going on television. Like, I've been doing this job for like 13 years and I'm still terrified to go on television, actually. And I know it's because you put yourself out there, and the abuse and the comments and the anxiety of what people will say online, it's a lot. And it's something that politicians, I can have a choice not to do it. You don't have that choice. How do you deal with the anxiety? What would you say to women who are thinking, I want to go into politics, but I don't think I'm able to put myself out there like that?
Yeah, and I wish I could say something so inspiring that would just make it all feel better, but I have to say it is the thing that I find the hardest about the job. Like, honestly, I find it incredibly stressful and scary. And I suppose the only thing I can say is that it's getting better with time, you know, but like, even like that, I was on the Week in Politics yesterday and like, just so nervous beforehand. Like, honestly, I can't eat, you know, dry mouth, sweats, like,
yeah,
the full hog. Like, it's so daunting. And, but like, I have to say that, you know, and I still get very nervous when I go in to speak in the door, admittedly, but it's getting better with time. You know, and like, you know, I've done that a good few times now, so it's getting better. And the more I do the TV stuff as well, I suppose that gets better too. But, you know, there's also, you know, perhaps I was thinking this recently, there's ways and means of dealing with this and experts in that area that can help deal with nerves and all of those things. And it's probably completely natural. You know, everybody in politics would get it. So I will hopefully, if we're back here next year, have sorted it out, and then I will have some very solid advice.
I'd like to hear that myself, actually. So I'll be texting you looking for updates, because I do think it's a thing. You know, I think the anxiety and the stress, and I'm right there with you. It does get easier with time, but I still get the same kind of suddenly feeling like, oh my God, am I going to get sick?
Yeah, how am I going to do this? I'm just going to do this. I won't be able to say anything.
Yeah, you're just like, but it does get better with time. And I think that's definitely a good message to get out. I suppose the other side of things is, and I hate that it kind of comes back to this sort of like idea of kids, you know, women, kids, politics, can't do it, et cetera, et cetera. But it is a massive deal. And, you know, we know, like, it's completely the fact that the burden falls on women when it comes to childcare for a variety of reasons, generally speaking. And you're working on a bill at the moment that would address the issue of maternity and paternity leave for politicians. I'd love to hear, like, where's that bill at the moment, and what's the path forward? Because I think that would help in terms of getting women to run.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I remember it was not long after I got elected, I raised it with the Taoiseach in a promised legislation slot, just to be like, are you aware that there's no maternity provisions for councillors, senators, yeah, and TDs, and it's 2021? And, you know, like, even, so straight away, you can be working with the Bills Office with one motion at a time. And I really wanted to legislate for that, because I just think, like that, the positive impact it would have if we had more women in politics is just, I can't wait, basically.
Yeah.
And he was really like, yeah, no, you're right. We need to work on that. Like, you'd rarely get such a positive response from the Taoiseach when you're in opposition, in terms of like, I'll work on that now and I'll get back to you straight away or whatever.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it's really complicated. And, you know, we need to send a clear message that there is no such thing ever as, you shouldn't have to choose between having a career or a family. And, you know, the fact that there's no maternity provisions for politicians in Ireland does kind of send out the wrong message in that sense. And, you know, actually, I'll take the opportunity as well to say, like, I think Helen McEntee, the Minister for Justice, is showing great leadership here. And I'm delighted to see it. Just saying, no, I will be taking my maternity leave, because often what we've seen in the past, people go, no, I won't be taking any time off, and like really trying to just not let it affect their political career and stuff, which is completely understandable, don't get me wrong. But it's great to see somebody saying, no, this is, you know, a necessary thing. Society needs to accept that. I totally agree with her. And I think she's showing really good leadership on that. I'm so glad she's going to take leave. But when we went about doing the bill, because then it was after we went about doing the bill that it transpired that the first female minister of cabinet was having a baby. That, you know, in order to, it's very tricky. So as a parliamentarian, there's certain duties that like only you can carry out because you're the elected representative. And that's kind of an unfortunate and very unique situation, I suppose, in that, you know, nobody else can vote for you. Nobody else can speak in the chamber on your behalf. And at the moment, you can't vote remotely. So that one of the obvious things that we need to change to allow people to take leave and not be, particularly from rural areas, to be traveling all the way to Dublin, is that we need to legislate to vote remotely. But because it's in our constitution, we have to have a referendum to do that. We won't be able to do that at the moment. Other things we can look, because of the pandemic, there's other things we can look into in relation to supports, like having a replacement to help out with your constituency work. At the moment, you can have a kind of part-time replacement. We need to change that to a full-time one. But what we can do now, and I think which is really important and really good, is change the legislation of the Local Government Act to allow for provisions for maternity leave for county councillors and city councillors. And that is so often where political careers start out, that it's a great starting point. And we can look at the, you know, next time we have a referendum, hopefully get in the vote remote stuff there too. But that would just, you know, require a short change in the Local Government Act. And instead of, you know, the council having to approve if you are if you have a good reason for taking 6 months off, we just change the legislation to say you give notice. Give notice that you're having a baby, whether it's adopted.
So the amendment to that act, that can be done quite easily. That would apply for councillors, basically. So that's something that, if Micheál Martin really wants to, you know, put his money where his mouth is, he can go and ensure the government supports that now. And in terms of, I suppose, wider politicians in the Dáil, that's going to need a referendum because of the remote working, is it?
Yes, for the Dáil, we should have a referendum, not for the council. They can actually vote remotely already. Council meetings are happening remotely as we speak throughout the pandemic.
Interesting. And, you know, obviously there is always a couple of referendums building up in the cards coming down the roads. That's something that maybe could be campaigned for now, or could be added to a list of forthcoming. Obviously, we're not in a place to talk about it right now. We're not in place in the terms of.
Jennifer, like you say, with other referendums coming up, most important to mention when we're, Women for Election, it's really International Women's Day, that we need a referendum on, still says in the constitution that a woman's place is in the home. So
I know. Sometimes I remember that's there and I just think, what year is it again? Is it 2021? I just have to check the calendar. Yes, well, those can go together, and perhaps, you know, maybe next year on International Women's Day, that could be the best way of actually showing that the political system holds women in enough high regard to actually bring in changes that would matter. So actually, just so you mentioned Helen McEntee, wasn't it just fascinating that when she announced she was pregnant, it was a lot of this, oh my God, how will this work? She's the Minister for Justice. Okay, how does she take time off? Who replaces her? What does the cabinet handbook say? Because it was the first time. It's like, how is that possible? It's great to see. And you're right, I would agree with you in terms of the maternity and her taking actual time off, because, it, you know, there is always a presumption in politics. You have to work all the hours or else you're not dedicated. It's insane. And just kind of briefly mentioned there the pandemic. I think you've been very vocal on the fact that there's been a disproportionate burden that has fallen on women. What are the, in terms of your constituency and your constituents, what are the main issues that are coming to you at the moment in that regard? A couple of the main topics.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the obvious one, the one that everybody's really feeling, is the burden of the caring role and doing, you know, childcare and working from home, and our schools are closed. Of course, you know, the vast majority of our frontline workers, nurses, are women, and of course the student nurses are predominantly female also. You know, one of the hardest things, I think, that we all know, and we knew from the first lockdown, so it's a shame that we haven't done more to support people, is, you know, for people with disabilities and their families, you know, not having special schools to go to, and, you know, different support organizations for people with disabilities, that caring role has also fallen disproportionately on women. So like the list goes on. We've already mentioned domestic violence, so I won't go into that, but there was a massive surge in relation to cases of domestic violence. And like I said, not adequate funding for the amazing support services out there, not adequate resources for them. An incredibly, incredibly difficult time. The issues in relation to maternity restrictions in the hospitals. And, you know, that recently we saw, you know, because they're all things that came out through the pandemic. But then, of course, there's so many issues that are just ongoing issues for women in Irish society that, like, haven't gotten perhaps the airtime or the public attention that they deserve because the pandemic has taken over absolutely everything. So, like, you know, the cervical check scandal is this ongoing issue, but we saw Lindsay Bennett, that amazing Cork mum of two, and, you know, that kind of settlement outside the courts, you know, still no proper justice for these women. And I suppose just we've touched on the mother and baby homes issue, but even, you know, most recently, just this week, so in recent weeks, we found out that the commission allegedly destroyed the 550 witness testimonies. We have no idea what the legal basis for the destruction of these testimonies was. The Data Protection Commission is seeking that legal basis. The obvious thing that we need to do is extend the life of that commission. Like, the very least at this point, survivors deserve answers. And if the commission dissolves, there is nobody there to answer those questions. Again, nobody's held accountable. So, like, there is, from today, Jennifer, 6 days until the commission dissolves. The minister can and should extend the life of the commission to allow people more time. The commission was extended, in fact, several times when the commission needed more time. And now that survivors want a bit of time to get the answers that they deserve, they're trying to say that it's not possible. We all know that it is. And I just, you know, encourage everybody to, you know, be great. I think the biggest women's rights issues essentially in Ireland, when we really look at it, like, there was obviously our reproductive rights in relation to the referendum. But, like, this is the biggest women's rights issue in Ireland, you know, in reality, aside from that, like, the amount of women that were incarcerated, I think we incarcerated more women than any other country in the world in Ireland. And, you know, the justice is not being done. An apology that, you know, abdicated responsibility, despite the fact that we know the state facilitated this. You know, people's children being sold abroad, illegal vaccine trials, all of these things. And, like, they were, the commission only formed because of the discovery of 800 babies in a disused septic tank. Like, you couldn't actually write this cascade of abusive events. And then that's why they were forced to form a commission. It's not like they went about trying to provide justice for these people. They were made to do that when there was discovery of the mass graves. Then the commission happened. We find out, and bear in mind, they only investigated 18 homes of 100 and something. So we still don't have a full picture. So we hear about, like, the thousands of deaths, the mass infant graves, and the commission essentially, so they did this kind of fact-finding exercise. But of all of the evidence that they got towards the committee and the confidential committee, they decided that only the survivors' witness testimonies were not considered fact. They were considered contaminated evidence because they spoke to each other. When everybody knows that, you know, politicians spoke to each other, people in the religious order spoke to each other, and their evidence wasn't considered contaminated. So this report says, oh, we can't prove that there was forced adoptions. We can't prove any of these things when there is actual massive amounts of proof within that report, within the witness testimonies. And now they've tried to destroy the testimonies, say that they told survivors that orally, despite the fact that the paperwork they sent out to them in advance just said, we'll ask you for permission to record you. It never said, and then we'll delete it and we won't take a transcript. None of that. Then they said, you know, oh, they're not recoverable. We checked, we investigated the situation, they're not recoverable. And say, oh, actually they might be. It's like, what investigation happened to say that they weren't recoverable? Obviously no investigation, because they potentially are recoverable. So there's too much detail, but, like, this, the actual, like, from, you know, all it takes, you know, all it took back then in a way was for loads of people in positions of power to do nothing, to allow this to happen. And then the work, can you think of anything worse than that? You don't think you can. And then you go, that it's continuing today in 2021. There's still a whole lot of people in positions of power who are doing nothing when they could do loads to provide justice. You can imagine a whole different scenario whereby, of course, the commission will be extended if they've unanswered questions in relation to deleting testimonies, where we say, you know, of the mass infant graves all over the country, do survivors want the coroner to go in and, you know, find out the DNA of the bodies, find the fate of all of these disappeared children, to know, were they sold abroad, illegally? Were they buried in a mass grave or in a septic tank? You know, they could do all of these things and nothing is happening. So it continues. It continues today, and I just encourage everybody to. There's a vote on this on Thursday. My party, Social Democrats, are bringing forward a motion on Wednesday to extend the commission. There's a huge push from women in political parties in government, like Fair Play to Deputy Niamh Smith has been calling for this, and she's asking the Taoiseach to allow a free vote on this because it's so important. So the more that all of us push for it, the more likely we are to get a free vote. And if we get a free vote, I am so sure that we can extend this commission and give some bit of justice.
Absolutely. And there does seem to be almost a view in government, doesn't there, that, well, this was the commission's job to do a report and they haven't made themselves available for questioning, but it's not our job to explain that report. We're the government, you know. And Leo Varadkar said last week, no, it's a flaw. You know, it's a flaw. You know, clearly it's more than a flaw. It's a major problem. And it is extraordinary to read the report and see, you know, a conclusion that women, there were no evidence of forced adoptions, whereas in the testimonies, women talked about screaming, looking out the window, screaming as their baby was driven away. I mean, how can you marry those two? They don't compute. They don't go together at all. And in terms of the last issue, yeah, like I completely agree about this idea that some of the testimonies have been destroyed. And there was a narrative that came out then, including in the media, that, well, women were told that these would be deleted. Why can't they remember? They were told, you know, and we were allowed to believe it was in writing. But actually, you go through the legislation, you go through every piece of anything written down that underpins the statutory instruments, you name it. You go into the leaflets that were given to the women as they went into the commission, and not anywhere did it say written down at any stage that I could find, certainly, and I know yourself, that they were going to be destroyed. And there's no legislative backing, it appears, and they rely on the terms of reference, but even the terms of reference don't. So the mind boggles, truly. So yeah, I definitely think that this is a massive, massive issue. So we'll be very interested to see what happens on Thursday, the vote. It's a huge issue. And do you think, I suppose, finally, in terms of the commission, you know, obviously a lot of the women and other people who contributed towards it, they're not happy, and you can completely see and understand why. Is there a scope maybe for another forum, a different space for women to tell their stories? Because we know some women said, the way the story appears, that's not the way I told it. There's errors in this and it's disputed and that's wrong. Is there perhaps a potential for a new forum for women to discuss it, maybe something government led, so then if there are questions to answer, there's somebody to answer those questions?
Yeah, I suppose something could be formed, and you know, it's unfortunate that the commission wasn't formed in this way, that like for survivors to actually put their trust again in something like this is a big ask, and it's incredible and brave that they did this after the way they've been treated for decades. But ideally, the commission would have been set up, and something would be great if something was set up in the future in a way that is sort of, you know, in line with, you know, international human rights standards in relation to truth-telling exercises around human rights violations like we saw in Ireland. Mm-hmm. You know, that the commission wasn't set up to help survivors or to provide them with information. And it would have been, you know, really welcome if that had been the purpose of it. Because, you know, it's not about, oh, why would there be a bias? Like, it's not about a bias. Like, there's a clear wrong and right here. People were incarcerated and tortured, and their children taken and sold abroad and put into mass graves. And, you know, all of this stuff that, like, it absolutely should have been set up with the intention to provide information to people that they've never had in relation to their own stories, to provide redress and justice. Like, part of the exercise of the commission, I think, should have been establishing what redress would help. You know, we can never right the wrongs of the past, but, you know, we can do our best to make up for them now, and they like that they can have been made up for. But is it, you know, things like the commission could have been involved in, you know, like, you know, giving people access to, for example, like basic, we're talking about very basic information, like what is my name, my birth name, who are my birth parents? You know, I think an exercise in like, what do you need? If this was part of the investigation, it would have been so good and so the right way to do it. Like, what redress service do you need? You know, they talk about the medical card that they're giving, but they're actually giving a medical card which is ex gratia. So this is like a gift from the state rather than something you're entitled to because of a wrongdoing, which people are. And you only get one if you're in an institution for more than 6 months. So like, all of these, it's just horrible. It's just not, it's almost nasty. So if it had been like, you know, what kind of medical card would you like? Like what, you know, what extra services do you need? Like things like legal support, if you want to take a case, mental health supports, psychiatric supports, all kinds of healthcare, you know, there's just so many things that could have been done. Like, you know, as a result of that report, wouldn't it be great if things like the DP, the there was, you know, prosecutions against perpetrators of the crimes, for example, like where is the actual justice? No proper redress, no prosecutions, no coroner examinations, no answers, recordings of their testimonies that they were so brave to go and give, a medical card for some people, and like that, what are they going to do about the other 100 plus institutions that haven't been investigated yet? What about the Ryan report that went into the industrial abuse in the schools? Like those archives were sealed for 75 years and the Ryan Commission still exists, imagine. And they're saying, we can't extend this commission. The Ryan Commission is still in existence. Ryan's not on the payroll. Shouldn't be about a money message. You know, and in relation to the Magdalen laundries as well, there has never been an actual sincere attempt to provide justice to these people that have experienced the worst human rights violations imaginable. And I think, you know, I can't speak for all women, but like, I'm, you know, so proud to be Irish and like, I love that we got independence and all of that stuff. But like, the reality is that on that day, essentially, things went downhill for women in Ireland. When the church and the Irish state took over together, that's when women really started to get a hard time. You know, it was a bad thing for women, unfortunately. And like that, most of us were still like, I'm still so proud to be Irish. But when I think about this situation around the mother and baby homes and the response, the pathetic attempt at an apology, the, you know, the refusal to extend the commission and the nonsense excuses for it, I am truly ashamed to be Irish. Like, it's such an Irish problem that, like that, it was just, because like, I remember being in school and there was an instance of sexual abuse from the church, you know, in relation to the students in the school. And like, I don't have a single anecdote about that, Jennifer. All I remember is the silence around it. The silence was deafening. And, you know, in reality, like, that is just continuing. What are they doing? Just nothing. And sometimes I think people are scared to speak out about this and nobody wants to offend people on the commission. I totally get that. But when we stay silent in order to not offend, we offend the many thousands of people who've experienced the worst human rights violations imaginable at the hands of this state and a religious order, you know? I think it's just high time justice was served. I can't emphasize enough because there's only 6 days until the commission dissolves.
Absolutely. And actually, we might just go on that note to some of the comments and questions then, a couple on the mother and baby homes. Brida Birmingham says, Catherine Corliss is the phenomenal voice for those women who had no agency. We have opportunities today. We need to back each other more. Another woman standing in her power like Catherine Corliss is Vicky Phelan, challenging social norms revolving around the silence of women. Keep moving forward, Holly. We need your voice. Thanks a million for that. And we have another comment then. We have a question actually, sorry, from Suzanne Murphy, which we might try and get through some of the questions quickly enough because it's a good few. Holly, you're an inspiration. What do you think is the reason behind all the reluctance to investigate fully? That's a great question. Thanks, Suzanne.
This is something that I literally lie awake and I think about, like, what is the story? Why is this happening? And I think, like, I can only speculate. So anything I say here is not based on anything, you know, in concrete or anything like that. But like, there's, from my perspective at this point, there's clear blatant delay tactics, blatant lying, to be honest with you. You know, when you kind of look at how these events have unfolded, you know, back in October, you know, the Data Protection Commission said this. Actually, no, it turns out the Data Protection Commission said that in relation to GDPR applying and people's rights. They have ignored these people's rights and they continue to. And then, we gave a copy of the report to every single survivor. Not one survivor had a copy of the report. You know, then more recently, the testimonies are not recoverable. Oh, actually, they might be recoverable. Like, what is actually going on here? It's gone to a point where we're like, that, okay, so that's lies. You know, that's what we're getting. That is the reality. And like, I suppose it wasn't that long ago is the truth as well. So went on for decades, starting from the 1920s up until the mid 90s. And like I kind of touched on earlier, that it takes a lot of people in positions of power doing nothing for something like this to be allowed to happen, mm-hmm. or to facilitate something like this, to enable it, and therefore to condone it. So it's not that long ago, the mid 90s. And presumably there's a lot of people who are, you know, good people who just didn't do anything about it or whatever, but like, that's not the priority here. You can, yeah. Everyone can understand how sometimes perhaps you can be a good person and you don't stand up, you don't do something, or you don't call it out or whatever. That is not a reason to not provide justice for these other people. Our priority is not there, should not be there. But I suspect that perhaps that comes into it to a certain extent, because I can't understand. There is a blatant reluctance. And what we're seeing now this week is blatant delay tactics until the commission is dissolved. So like Minister O'Gorman asked the commission for the disaster tapes, the ones they suddenly found when there was uproar about it on Friday, and the commission didn't get back to him, and he's just like sort of waited till Monday. Like, then we only have 6 days. Like, the level of, like, obviously if you're the minister and you really want those files, you pick up the phone, you send someone from your staff team over to the commission to get them. You don't just send a letter to the commission. So like, I can only speculate, but I think there's a culture there as well. It's like society has moved past it. I think all of us have. But like within departments and all of those things, they're never trying to provide justice. They're always trying to protect their own selves. So when we elect people to go into those departments, because I can only imagine what the minister is going through. And like, I've gone through moments of feeling actually quite bad for him. I talk about being left holding the bag when you go into government and you end up with this in your department, when you'd imagine being in the Department of Justice. I'm wondering, is it any, it's probably not a coincidence the Green Party ended up with this brief. Maybe the other parties knew what was going into what brief in advance of giving out the ministerial positions. Do you know what I mean? But at the end of the day, fair enough, you're left holding the bag and you're in a shit position, but you are the minister. And I just would love to know, if you went into the, if you guys went to the department and say, look, no, I'm not doing this. I'm putting my foot down. We're extending the life of the commission. Like, the only excuse they have for this at the moment is they're pretending. They're basically acting like copying something doesn't exist, copying things. But in the October Act, they actually ended up doing that. We, you know, we managed to get that amendment in that they would keep a copy of the archive. The minister would, so survivors could put in a subject matter access request. So one copy going to TUSLA, one copy going to the minister. And now it's like, oh, we need to extend the life of the commission so people can get answers as to why their testimonies were destroyed, or see if they're recoverable. And they're like, oh, but we can't, because the files have to go to the minister, and then the Data Protection Commission won't be able to investigate.
It's extraordinary.
Like, you can just copy them.
It is extraordinary. It is extraordinary. And we have a comment here from Gemma Hussey. Not a question, a congratulation from someone who is a founder of the Women's Political Association, who would like to say how good it is to see the work of Women for Election. It was a very cold and hard place for women when I got into it, but it would never have happened without solidarity and support of other women. So keep up the good work. Thanks, Gemma. We have a few questions from anonymous attendees. First one says, do political parties not provide media training to TDs? I guess that's in reaction to our conversation about dealing with
I actually do sense that most TDs have had media training. And like, I did, I remember saying to Catherine Roche when we first kicked off, like, can we please get some media training? And this would be like in advance of like an interview on my local radio station or something. I'd be that nervous about something like that. And perhaps, like, you know, we're new party, we just kicked off with so much to figure out and to do that we just never did media training. And it is something we'll do. But also, I remember, you know, not that long in, we're saying, oh, we'll organize the media training. And we're kind of saying, well, we wait till we can do it off Zoom, you know, because it's something that you kind of maybe want to be quite interactive. And but I think that you're right. There is normally media training for TDs.
I
can't wait.
There's another question here. Any advice for addressing the type of misogyny when a power dynamic at play, for example, a male line manager who has the power to pass or failure probation at work, potentially directly knock-on effect for income, etc., in that context? So advice for addressing misogyny where there's the power dynamic is your bosses, I suppose, are male and have an impact on your life potentially. Any thoughts on that?
That's so difficult. I guess it depends on the exact scenario, but like that, if it's having an effect on your pay, I would say take that to somebody who's, you know, if we're talking about the rank, if that person is higher up than you and it's affecting your pay, I would go above them in relation to that, because that's quite legal if it's affecting
Absolutely.
Your pay.
and perhaps also always take notes and write things down if there's stuff going on as well,
yeah.
You know, and have your own contemporaneous note. Question from Al Sherry, who is my husband, for full disclosure. How does Holly feel about the small but noticeable rise of far-right agitators in Ireland, and what can be done to address it?
I feel like, yeah, I mean, I don't even feel like they're that noticeable. I feel like it is a very kind of small group, mm-hmm. maybe a bit loud, like you often
yeah.
have the loud minority. But I suppose what I think is, in like in relation to, for example, like Trump, I literally, for the entire Trump term, never followed him on Twitter, never clicked into an article about him. I mm-hmm. wish that we'd all ignored him because he didn't deserve the time of day. And I think you know, obviously there is a point and there's times where you can't ignore certain things that need to be addressed and called out and all of those things. But for the most part, my approach is to literally ignore it. It's like, you know, when you sort of go into a debate about something or something and then they bring the bar so low in mm-hmm. the debate that it's like completely changed the entire nature of the conversation. And you're at a point where nobody wants to be in a discussion.
Yeah.
You know, like, for example, if you're, you know, talking about something that everybody's on board with, like marriage equality. And then someone's like, oh, but it's just wrong. And you're like, right. Well, I'm not going to start the conversation. I'm not having that conversation actually anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it just brings it to too low a point that it actually, it lowers the tone of the entire debate and the and politics then as well, if we go to that place for a conversation. Because
yeah, so don't give the oxygen basically there. A question from Kira O'Rourke. Hi, could you please ask Holly whether she feels a lot of pressure as the only young female Cork TD to represent all women, and how she copes with that? I was wondering the same thing, because I remember talking to you Christmas and you said you didn't want to get pigeonholed in kind of always talking about women's issues, but that's actually because you're the only representative, you kind of have to do that, don't you?
Yeah, and like, to be honest, I also love it. Like, you know, mm-hmm. big proud feminist forever, always have been. And, you know, in a way it's great, but yeah, I suppose that just like in relation to things like going into politics, one of my massive, big, most motivations was in relation to climate change and our agriculture sector. But generally, like, nobody wants to hear about that or talk about it. So I suppose that's what I mean by pigeonhole, that I'd love, I look forward to doing work on that. Mm-hmm. And it actually is really interesting. Maybe another day we could do something on that, because when you actually engage in it, it's fascinating and so mm-hmm. important. Like, what has transpired is that so much of the representations I get are in relation to women's issues. And I have to say, I love that. I'm very happy to do it. And yeah, I think maybe I get a bit more than other TDs, perhaps by virtue of being the only female representative in the county.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's great. And it's not, because it was the question, is it a bit daunting or something?
Yeah, the question's gone there now, but it was, I think, is it daunting? Basically, you have to deal with all of the issues for all of the women in this massive part of the country.
Yeah, no, I love that bit of it. I love it, actually, because I love that bit. You know, I like engaging in those issues and trying to help and do my bit. Like, I wish there was more women in Cork doing it too. But I suppose that maybe perhaps the daunting bit is that I hope I don't let anyone down. You know, when you're the only woman doing it, so you're always like, God, I hope, you know. But it's a total honour and pleasure to do it.
That's great. A question from Theresa Newman. Who did Holly vote for before Sock Dems came along? Ooh.
Probably the Green Party. Like, so actually, basically, I hadn't voted that much. I'd voted when I was in Ireland for elections, obviously, anytime they were on. But like, I'd moved abroad fairly lively after my leaving cert. And so I remember voting. Well, actually, the only time I actually remember voting before I moved abroad was for the presidential election in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually the first time I ever engaged in politics. So I went and canvassed for David Norris.
Yeah.
I think I was 19. Because
yeah,
I thought,
that was, yeah.
Yeah, I thought he'd be the president most likely to change basically the injustice around the LGBT community in Ireland and the way they were treated. Now, Michael D did a great job of that too. I was delighted to see him get elected. But I remember that was, at the time, I was thinking, this injustice is the thing that I feel the most strongly about, so I'm going to go out and try and get this person elected. And then I moved home. So then I was basically gone after that. And then I moved home early. I was abroad for years and moved back earlier than what I was going. I knew I was going to move home to take on my family farm and business. And then I did it a bit earlier than what suited, because I wanted to vote for the marriage equality referendum. So I think, like, I probably had never voted in a general election because I hadn't been here. voted for David Norris, voted for marriage equality, voted for repeal, and then I started voting for myself.
I love that. We've got loads of other questions, but I'm not sure what the situation is in relation to time, Katrina, if you're...
I think we can go with them. If people want to leave, they can. But if Holly, if you're okay to take more, that'd be great, because it's a lot of time. Yeah, we're good here.
We'll take two or three more, Katrina, maybe.
Yeah, that's okay with you, Jennifer. That'd be great.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Actually, some of them are comments. Sharon, I hope I don't pronounce your name wrong, Sharon. My eyes are going to be goggly. Sharon McManaman. McManaman. Sorry, it's my fault. My screen is fuzzy. Deputy Cairns, saw you yesterday on This Week in Politics and thought you did very, very well. You communicated your ideas quite clearly. Solidarity from Donegal. Sorry for mentioning your name, Sharon. Question from Marta. I have two questions and hopefully not too personal. Would you say that you've received sympathy and support from other women TDs? All in all, are women TDs collaborative with each other, maybe more than men?
Yes, I have to say, and it's one of the really, really lovely things about being in politics. There is a female solidarity cross-party that is, it's so, I can't actually, I don't have the words for how nice it is. I remember when I started on Cork County Council, and I didn't really expect that. I didn't know, I hadn't thought about it. Mm-hmm. And on the first day of the council, you take your seats and you elect the mayor, and then there's like a meal. So yeah. Have the meal. And you know, everyone went to the pub afterwards. And remember, there was like just some, like this man being annoying and, you know, maybe a little bit too close and stuff. And, you know, the other female councillors who've been in the council a long time just swooped in. You know, and they're like, oh, that Holly, you know, whatever. And they were like, oh, that's what it's like. You know, we've got you, kind of a thing. And I was like, oh, that's so nice. And it is throughout. So, for example, you know, and some of the women really stand out we do not agree in politics at all. But like, for example, since starting in the Dáil, Claire Curran in Sinn Féin is just, you know, there's that real sense of female solidarity with her. Jennifer Carroll McNeill in Fine Gael, I think. And I'm actually, like, the list goes on, and it's so, so nice. And there's a women's caucus in the Dáil.
Yes.
We meet, and it's my favourite meeting. And it feels quite different to the other meetings that you attend. Similarly, I'm on the Disability Committee, and there seems to be a lot more women on that committee. Really nice.
That's great.
I won't go into the details of it, but there's a few different examples of where women in other parties have shown solidarity that you wouldn't see cross-party. That I was so surprised and humbled to see it. It's lovely.
That's so good. It's really nice to hear, to be honest. Question from anonymous attendee. There is evidence that election posters as a tool disadvantaged women because, similar to TV appearances, female candidates get heavily judged on their appearance. They're also bad for the environment, etc. Can we push for a reduction of the use of election posters down to one per constituency in an agreed location? For many women, the thought of putting your picture on a poster is really daunting. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, it's bizarre when you get your posters up and then you're driving around in space. It is so bizarre. But yeah, women's posters do get targeted. I remember, I can't remember if it was the local or the general election. I think it was in the local elections. I remember somebody, it was so targeted, so nasty, took my poster down. They would have had to like go out with a van and a ladder. Took it down from one area and then drove like quite a distance past one specific graveyard to another graveyard where I have a family member, and screwed it upside down into a tree with a drill. So the effort, the ladder, the drill, the picking the specific place, really bad. But
where did they get the time?
You'd wonder. But there's a few different things in relation to election posters that I think. So, for example, posters are really important for new candidates, you know, for people to know about you. So incumbents have a huge advantage because people already know who they are. They recognize their name on the ballot. So if we want to, you know, encourage, you know, more participation of women and you know, across the board, we need better representation. It's really important that there's ways of letting people know that you exist. And I think for a lot of the general public who are not engaged in politics, actually the thing that draws your attention to the election is those posters on the side of the road. But I agree, the environmental, like, it's awful. And it's so labor intensive as a campaign to try and get posters up, especially when you have a constituency the size of this one. It's huge.
Yeah.
But there are other things we could do. So like, for example, like that, if there was a the person wrote in the question spoke about a designated space. Mm-hmm. I think that's very important, but I think we perhaps need quite a lot of them, that maybe billboards, like all billboards, you know, perhaps a bit of, depending on your newspapers, like in rural areas, there's more local newspapers and that's more affordable to advertise in. But if you're a candidate where there isn't a local paper, if it's Dublin or something, for example, it's very expensive to take out an ad. So I just think we need to, if we're going to get rid of posters, we have to ensure that there is a way to give new candidates that chance and to make sure that people see it, because we can't rely on people to, you know, watch The Week in Politics, for example, or tune into Drive Time, or, you know, for the non-engaged people in politics, there has to be a way as effective, I think, as posters to give those new candidates a chance.
Okay, brilliant. And then the last question then, because I'm aware we're way over time, from Jennifer McConnell, what is the Social Democrat strategy for developing representation across all counties? Obviously very relevant now, coming up to next elections and whatnot.
Is it coming up already?
I was actually there, like, what are you talking about? I'm always in election mode.
Yeah, I suppose, like, basically, like, I know that so many people would kind of, you know, write Social Democrats off as a very small party, and I understand that. We are a small party. But we're growing really quickly. Like, when you consider it, from, you know, 0 to 19 councillors in our local election, and then to triple our TDs in the general election. And I remember after the election, then, you know, because change can happen so quickly. I've really experienced that in my constituency, to go from 0 to having a council seat and a Dáil seat in the space of a year. Change can happen really, really quickly. And I always felt like I would have loved a more progressive option to vote for, but that option literally was not there. There was nobody who represented me for me to vote for. And everyone's like, oh, rural areas, you know, they have no time for that. They're all just conservative. But like, people in rural Ireland are not conservative by default. We're able to understand facts and, you know, engage in meaningful debates and believe in a more progressive Ireland and want that. So like, I think, you know, I remember that. So then when the election happened, and, you know, it was like, I couldn't believe that we were having another Fianna Fáil and Fianna Gael government. So I was totally disillusioned. I remember talking to Catherine, one of my party leaders, and I was like, I can't believe this. Oh, gosh, we're having another. And she was like, you know, if it feels like that, and that there'll never be a change, like that it's, oh my God. And, you know, we've 6 TDs, like, how are we ever going to get? But like, the reality is that the tide is turning now. So historically, Fianna Fáil and Fianna Gael would have 90% of the vote. And now they can barely hold the government together between them. They need the Green Party as well, and they basically have like the regionals supporting them. You know, like this is it. This is the moment that it's changing. And like, I would be, we've had a huge surge in membership. It's more than doubled since the election, way more, I think. I don't actually know the numbers. Like that, in Cork Southwest, I was laughed in the face when I said I was standing for the election. In the newspapers, in the predictions, I was completely written off. They didn't mention me in the predictions of the newspapers because they thought there was no point.
And yeah, journalists always get those wrong. Always. Next time I'm not even going there. I'm not even.
Well, I'm sure if it was you, Jennifer, you would have at least mentioned all of the candidates.
Absolutely.
But that's how much people just thought it was absolutely laughable that I was going for the election. So I'm actually really confident that if we had an option for people to vote for, like, I always say it, and it sounds a bit cheesy maybe, but like, I think most Irish people are Social Democrats. They just haven't necessarily realised it yet. Like, I didn't realise it until I looked into all of the parties when I decided to go into politics.
Yeah.
But like, as a very basic example, you know, Roisin being the architect of Sláintecare, and that being a really kind of socially democratic policy, that like, everybody believes that no child should be more or less entitled to healthcare based on how deep their parents' pockets are, that kind of thing. Like, it's like, you know, we do have this kind of culture of voting for like, somebody who looked after that issue for me, that pothole, somebody who claims to have gotten a house for me, although I hope TDs can't, you know, bump people up housing lists. That was something very wrong with that. You know, there's all of these things. Oh, my family have always voted for this party. If we actually all broke it down, and, you know, in other countries, for example, in Sweden or somewhere, you vote for the party on the ballot. There isn't this like focus on the candidate and their face all over the posters everywhere. And I think if actually Ireland was met with that, if we were voting for just policies and that's what we looked into, we probably have a socially democratic government. So it's our job to really explain to people what the party is about, why we formed, why you do the hard job trying to start a party, and mm-hmm. build it, because it is incredibly hard. And it's because we genuinely believe that it is the future, that people would like that option to vote for. And like I was in the local and general election, I'm quietly confident that we'll defy the odds.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Holly. Thanks a million. I really enjoyed that and I cannot believe it's 20-8.
Wow. That's been amazing. Holly and Jennifer, I'm just intrigued and glued here, and I'm mindful that so many people have stayed with us. So that's why I was suggesting we wind it up. That was incredible. I think, Holly, I couldn't summate all, and Jennifer, that you've touched on, but I think in some, we do need more women, and you're a prime example of why we need more women. And I think your reflection on not having the option to vote for women right around the country really marries with the strategy that Women for Election are trying to drive, which is to really look at where those pinch points are around Ireland where we don't have women. And one of the big issues in terms of why we don't have enough women elected is because we haven't enough women being put on the ticket in winnable seats. So I'm delighted that you've been able to join us. Misogyny hasn't gone away yet. We have a good bit to do, and you've touched on so much of that. I'd love to have a whole session with you on your role and your work around women in agriculture and all that you're doing, because we didn't even get really to touch into that, and not even women in agriculture, but agriculture and your role in leading that. So but more maybe you'll come back to us next year and let us know how you're getting on with all the issues. Best of luck with the work on the Mother's Baby Home over the next few days. I think everybody listening will be quite moved by how you have made that quite explicit, and anybody following the conversation of the last few weeks can be nothing but shocked by the ability to do nothing to prevent something from happening. So Jennifer, thank you so much for your time, your excellent preparation, your questions. To everybody listening, we've had a fantastic audience, been nearly 100 people with us for the whole evening. Gemma Hussey, I want to give you a special shout out. It's incredibly privileged to have you with us and listening to us, and it's on your shoulders and the shoulders of the many women who broke ground 30, 40, 50 years ago and 100 years ago, and even and before, when we go back, that we're all standing and driving the next wave. So thanks for everyone for listening. We have our Inspire School starts tomorrow night. We have a great bunch of women signed up for our Inspire Campaign School. Yes, campaigning starts now, particularly for 2024, for the local elections. So we're trying to get as many women ready for that as possible. And next Monday at 2:00, we're launching a very exciting research report, which is going to reflect the experiences of women who run for election, both in the locals, the generals, and in the European. So anybody who wants to find out more, go to our website. And tomorrow we'll be announcing our International Women's Day in Conversation, a guest who I think will be a surprise to you all. So look, keep an eye out for that. So thanks everyone for joining. We're on hashtag More Women on Twitter and womenforelection.ie. And thanks again to Holly and to Jennifer. Okay.
Thanks, Katrina.
Thanks,
Jennifer.
Many thanks to our guests in this episode, Deputy Holly Kearns and Jennifer Bray. We hoped you have enjoyed listening to them both. You can listen back to all our podcasts wherever you find your own podcasts, on social media and on womenforelection.ie.